Well, greetings and salutations.
Greetings.
Good to see you all this morning. I'm sure that you'd be crying too if you didn't get to come out for Sunday school. Well, maybe not, but anyway, good to have Sam with us today. And all of you. We've been studying in Luke. And I didn't see any reason to go elsewhere this morning, so that's where we're at. So we're in a section of Luke 11, 12, where we have a long series of sayings of Jesus, which consist of his criticism of the Pharisees, and Luke mentions another group, the lawyers. And it seems that the lawyers perhaps were a subdivision of the Pharisees. The same criticisms are leveled at only the Pharisees in Matthew's gospel. Matthew doesn't distinguish lawyers. And in general, we associate the Pharisees with the observance of the law in a very precise manner, according to their own interpretation of it. Some of these criticisms are very sharp. Jesus would tend to be judgmental by many of the things that he says here. And in our culture and world, it just I'm sure some people find it incredibly shocking if they actually read these, especially out loud. But I've sort of been raised in the church, so it doesn't seem as shocking to me. But I think that it is important for us to look at the specific content of the criticism of Jesus for the Pharisees. And so I've got a little presentation here. A lot of times we just go verse by verse, but this sort of separates out the verses that comprise the heart of his criticism and lets us think about them in this fashion. So let's look at this. Number one, we find in Luke chapter 11 that Jesus criticizes the Pharisees for what seem to be misplaced values. Okay, what is valuable in the world? This really is an important issue for all of us. What is valuable? What's valuable to you is what you spend your money on, right? When you have choices about what you're going to do with your resources, when you have choices about where you spend your time, what you find to be valuable determines what you do. In fact, I think if you examine your life, you'll find that you always do what you think is valuable. Always. Now, sometimes you say, I do things that I really don't want to do. Well, why would you do something that you don't want to do? Can you think of an example? Do you ever do things in your life you don't really want to do?
There's a greater value than doing just that or not doing that.
You want to please people around you or something.
Yeah, if we had an example, it would help us think about it. Can you think of anything in your life that you do or have done?
Pay bills.
Pay bills? You don't like doing that, Matt?
So the... Oh, yeah, it's a blast. But so sometimes the consequence of not doing it is something you want to avoid. So there's a want, but it's...
There's still a value involved, and so it's more important to you not to go to jail or not to have your name show up in the paper or whatever the consequence might be.
So you value your freedom.
your freedom higher than you value the discomfort and the inconvenience and the bank account emptying process of paying your bills. So it's still holds true that ultimately what you value the highest determines what you do.
And because some people don't pay their bills.
Some people don't pay their bills. That's right. So if you ever have any question in your mind, what is it that I value? Well, look at what you do. It's like a major revelation. In the crisis of your life, whenever you don't know which way to go, what you end up choosing is a reflection of what you value in your life. So that's a good thing to know, especially if you're examining yourself in light of God's view. I need to know how he sees me, because he sees the truth. He sees what you really value. And if you're not in tune with it, then you're walking in darkness. And you need to walk into the light. So, misplaced values is a very, very important topic to talk about and think about. And so Jesus criticizes the Pharisees for misplaced values. In Luke 11, verse 39, the Lord says unto the Pharisee who was hosting him, "Now you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but inside you are full of robbery and wickedness." So he does expose a problem there, what we would say is a problem, but his criticism is their activity, what they're doing, reflects that what they value is how things look on the outside. They haven't placed a value on what's going on inside. It's what counts for them is what is on the outside. And his criticism is that's not what's valuable. And of course, it doesn't reflect the truth about you, which is another issue. But we could see this as first and foremost a criticism of misplaced values in their life.
Keith?
Yes.
I'm thinking a different direction on this.
Okay, go for it.
But it still impresses me that there's this person that comes along that not only questions, contradicts the religious leaders at the time. If I was standing in the crowd, I think, wow, somebody has finally stood up.
Yes, I'm sure it would. Now, there were at least some of the people who weren't aware of the hypocrisy. Josephus speaks of the Pharisees as being the most popular with the people. And so to some people, it was a shocking thing to suggest that there was any problem with these leaders. So there's always somebody that knows the inside, and yeah, you're right there. That would be a real breath of fresh air to see the truth come out. But there's also the aspect of they held the position of authority and respect in people's minds. And Jesus is condemning several things. But first of all here, that they don't value what God values. You're just concerned about how things look on the outside.
Wouldn't that cause them to think, you think so, even the people that thought the Pharisees were way up high, all of a sudden, this person that is known to do miracles, has raised people from the dead, healed people, done spectacular things, and he's calling them into question. It starts to divide, and they start having to look here or there, which one's right. The Pharisees, they don't do the good. They talk. Talk, so to speak. They aren't doing good. Here's this person who's good, who they found no sin in. one am I going to listen to? Which one am I going to follow? And it's especially for a person who is truthful and seeking God.
And the truth is what Jesus ends up emphasizing so much in this, after this series of criticism. He really hones in on the issue of truth. What is truth? So, you know, there's different ways to, of course, think about Scripture, and the historical perspective is very valuable and insightful. So, yeah, I can appreciate where you're coming from there and putting yourself in their place. But I guess I'm more emphasizing me here now. What can I learn about what's important to God? What do I, you know, if Jesus is doing this kind of analysis of them, what kind of analysis is he doing of me? Because ultimately that's what I'm concerned about. There's a lot to reflect on, certainly from the historical setting as well.
It's easy for me to at least lose sight of it. And I agree with you. I need to apply it to me. But as I read scriptures, it's so familiar to me, it's easy to just kind of gloss over it. Well, that's the way it was. But what was really going on? What wrestling were people in their minds? And they were hearing this fresh for the first time. What do you think about this? You're the religious leaders, they're the established order. They can kick you out of the order, and you're out on your own if you disagree with them.
Yeah.
And here's this man that comes along, and he seems to behave as though it doesn't matter if the Pharisees reject me. This is what's right, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to proclaim it to everybody.
It was shocking, no doubt about it. And yet he was gathering crowds, so it was attractive as well, as you point out.
Keith, it's almost shocking to me to hear you say that Josephus said that the Pharisees were popular to the people because of our perspective.
Sure.
And it's like, you know, I just have such images of who they were and how they acted, and it's just kind of hard to believe.
Yeah. They were a serious political force, and there are a number of accounts that Josephus gives us in the history that he relates where the general direction that the country went was in response to their influence over other aspects. Is that ringing?
People.
Yep.
Okay, so values. What do you value? You want to examine all your life. Reflect on what it is that I value. And what would Jesus say if he were speaking to me instead of the Pharisees? Another example of misplaced values from Luke 11. Verse 42, he says, "Woe unto you, Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs and pass over judgment and the love of God." Okay, so here again, this is about what you raise to the top of importance. They were fastidious in their observance of tithing down to the herb. And wow, that kind of blows the mind. How do you even measure it? But anyway, they gave a tenth. We might say whether the priests wanted it or not, they got it. But pass over judgment and the love of God. Now, I mentioned the concept of judgment earlier on already today, and it's amazing how ideas catch on in society and and gain strength and prevalence. But one of the most common defenses that people use against somebody else critiquing their behavior or their attitudes or their positions is, "You're judging me." Have you ever heard that? Anybody ever heard that? "Don't judge me." Well, in Scripture, the term judgment and judge in general is essentially synonymous with justice. So when you talk about when the prophets in the Old Testament laud the judgment of God, in our mind, judgment is almost always negative, right? The last thing you want is to get judged. Unless, of course, you're talking about a court case and you're suing for damages, and then you like judgments, right? Large judgments in your favor. And so the concept of justice is actually always inherent in the concept of judgment. Even God's negative judgment is about justice, right? For wrongdoing. And so, don't get disinterested every time you see the word judgment. It's actually a good thing if you're on the right side of it. And so, Jesus condemns them here for valuing tithing to the nearest blade of grass, but passing over justice and love. It's about what you make valuable in your life. Now, while we're on the topic of judgment, I'd go one step further and asking you to think with me. What is the objective of judgment? Now, certainly we would say justice in one sense, but the whole process that, if you reflect even on man, and we set up courts, right? Part of civilization is a court system. And when you go to court, there are various procedures and rules for operation. What is the first objective of the judgment process? To find the truth, right? That, yeah. If whatever, you know, there's all kind of, you can go out in public and you can print anything you want, you can say whatever you want, but the court is supposed to be designed to find the truth. That should be a good thing, don't you think? And of course, if you feel like you've been wronged, you hear people wishing they could have their day in court, as the saying goes. Why do they want that? Well, it's supposedly so the truth will come out, which they feel like is on their side. God cares about the truth. And the defense that a lot of people use of, "You're just judging me," is a turning of that whole thing on its head, and trying to use this defense to keep the truth from being observed. Don't give in to that kind of pressure. Everybody makes judgments every day, and you have to. Judgment is a part of survival. It's a part of life. You make judgments. If you find yourself out hunting in the woods, and suddenly you encounter a grizzly bear which charges you growling, it doesn't cross your mind that maybe he's actually very kind and friendly and just wants to get to know you better. You make a judgment, and anything you have in your hands to shoot at him, you will use. There are analogies, direct analogies, to all sorts of people in life who come at you like a grizzly bear. And they somehow think that you're supposed to not judge them. I don't have a bad motive here, right? I'm not getting ready to tear your head off. Don't judge me. That's ludicrous. You have to make judgments in life. Now, what you don't have the liberty to do is to send people to heaven or hell. That's not your position. But you have to make judgments about what it is that they're up to. Here, it's maybe been several years ago now, there was some sort of crime committed in our community. And the word got out that there's somebody out who is entering homes and robbing people. Don't let anybody in your house. Don't, you know, watch out for this guy. Well, that's a pretty major judgment, isn't it? Well, it happens as a part of everyone's life all the time. And you should be, as a Christian, willing to forgive, willing to offer mercy, willing to be gracious, but you still, at the end of the day, have to make judgments about where people are coming from and what their intention is.
It's so ironic that the moment somebody tells me you're being judgmental, they have just made a judgment.
They've made a judgment, I reckon, haven't they?
That's so ironic. It's just, we would think a little bit deeper.
Yeah, you pick up the phone. It's a number you don't recognize. What are you going to do? If there's a long pause, you hang it up, right? Because you make a judgment. This is a robocall. This is somebody who's wanting to get something out of me. What a terrible person. Why did you make that judgment? That's not what the Bible is saying in cautioning you about judgment. You're admonished to make righteous judgments. And the observation that Jesus makes in the Sermon on the Mount, that they that judge shall be judged, is an observation of human nature. If you tend to be a judgmental person who constantly judge other people wrongly, you'll get that back. People treat that as though it's a suggestion that if I don't judge you, then God won't judge me. Well, that's nonsense. If you do what's wrong, God's justice will be on your trail. And so the kind of ways that we twist the scripture sometimes as a cover for our guilt and to conceal the truth is unfortunate. But that's...
Sorry, you weren't quite
done. I was done enough.
Okay. Do you think that some of that has come out of... I'm going to say something and then I may qualify it. So we had a period in history where Christians, it's the hellfire and brimstone kind of preaching, and people maybe reacting to people, preachers trying to act like a prophet and assume that they have the same knowledge that God-given knowledge that the prophets did. Of course, they didn't have knowledge. Never mind. But I don't know. I want to make sure that I understand where that's coming from and be careful, because I think my tendency in my earlier years was, you know, this is the truth. You say it and you accept it, or you walk, you know, whatever. I was just a little bit more less gentle with how I said what I believed. In school, I was called the judge. Got out of the van, you know, at lunchtime. Here comes the judge, here comes the judge. Because when I decided to follow Jesus, it was like, with my whole heart, this is what I am. And when you ask me why I do what I do, I'm going to tell you the verse that I'm based on. You know, I was just in a very different place. But I think that, and yet I also know that if we just respond to their reaction and don't speak the truth, that's a problem. So I'm not suggesting that there's never a place for a preacher to be forthright and express what he believes to be true. You know what I'm saying?
So I know what you're saying. And so I'm not trying to explain all the details of everything here. But I am saying that if you use the defense of don't judge me, effectively what you're saying is, I don't want to talk about the truth. I don't want to hear your opinion. I don't even want to talk about the subject. So shut up. And that's not a Christian position. If there's some issue that needs to be judged, let's look at it for what it is. What is the truth here? As opposed to shut you down.
And, you know, I know we've been so sensitized to be nice, to be gentle, where you look at Jesus and you realize there are people in our culture, like you said at the very beginning today, they would be offended by his approach. And yet he's God, so I always have to balance that. I'm not God. I don't have absolute knowledge like he had. So I have to humbly speak what I believe to be true. Anyway, I'm just wrestling with...
Right, and so that's why we're looking at the heart of his complaints. He says, you're not valuing the right thing. We should be stressing values, because he did. What is valuable? What is important? And if you're not stressing values, I don't have to make a conclusion, the right values. If you're not stressing his values, I don't have to make any big conclusions about, you know, you're on your way to hell. But I can tell you that you're not stressing what Jesus stressed. This should be a concern to you. Right? I don't have to pronounce your ultimate end or doom or whatever, but I can point out there's a difference here between what you're saying and what he said. Lucky you.
Yeah, we have to do that every time. So this is my first meeting, because I missed the first meeting that they had earlier because of miscommunication. So I did listen to the video, and the guy, it wasn't a bad topic. They're talking about trying to bring together different cultures, which I talked to my students. I've done that for decades, and I tried to explain to them other cultures don't think the way we do. Idea, because I think this way, and this is my approach, and everybody else in the world has that approach. That's not true. However, he used his example of you're in a car with a friend, and he has or she has an accident, and you're asked to testify. Will you testify against the friend? The vast majority of Americans, and the Swiss are the highest, they're on the 93 or above percentile, they would not lie for the friend. Canadians are next. U.S. is third, down to bottom is Venezuela, and Russia and India are too far behind. And he tried to dichotomize it. He had to choose the friend or the law. And that concerned me, because it was as if he was justifying lying. Because other cultures, like Koreans, would say, well, what kind of friend are you if you don't lie? You're a lousy friend. You can't be counted on. So we were asked if we made any comments, and I didn't say anything, nobody else said anything. The person who spoke that part made a few more comments, and then brought up again. But I'm going to say something, because I don't want it to pass that I support or I'm okay with this deception. So I spoke up in this online meeting, and I brought out the idea of deception, and that he tried to dichotomize it. and maybe there's something more important, the truth, versus law or the friend. And his questions were limited. And I posed to everybody, is this the kind of culture that we want, where it's okay to be dishonest? Because once you start going down this road and you compartmentalize and say, well, it's okay to be dishonest in this situation, then it's okay to be dishonest in other situations, is that the culture we want? And then I posed the question, do you want to buy a vehicle from somebody that's dishonest? Do you want a doctor or a nurse taking care of you that's dishonest? And I mentioned something that I've learned in this group, I was looking to keep. I told them, humans have a tremendous capacity to deceive themselves. I can't remember what else I said. I didn't know if anybody else had supported me. It really didn't matter if they were supporting me or not.
Sure.
It felt like it was the right thing to say, and I wasn't being ugly about it. But while I was talking, one of the other instructors, he was at his desk. He gave me a thumbs up. And he texted me later and thanked me. He said, I'm so disgusted with DEI that I didn't even watch the video. Thank you for speaking up. Well, the lady that was over that sheet came on and said a few more things, and she mentioned relationships. So I came back and I said, that's a very good point. Trust is the basis of relationships. If you break trust, then the relationship is broken.
That's good.
I'm sorry, I can't remember where I was going with this, but it was...
You have to stand up sometimes.
Yes, you have to stand up sometimes. And it really doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. If it's the right thing, and you understand it, and you do it. And I had to wrestle with it in my mind. Is this time to take a stand, or do I let it go? But when the moderator came back on the second time and said, are there any questions or comments, I decided to speak up.
Sure.
Now, what I didn't mention, later on the agenda, we're going to talk about artificial intelligence.
Uh-huh.
There's a huge concern among several faculty about being used for plagiarism and cheating. But some of you have already caught where this is going.
Yep.
We can compartmentalize and say it's okay to be dishonest in certain situations, but we don't want these students being dishonest in our class. I wasn't so blunt to say that, but I think if anybody was paying attention, it would have been lost on me that within 30 minutes, we're going to switch conversations from this honesty of testifying under oath versus AI and plagiarism and academic honesty.
Yes.
It's interesting how people think.
And so what we encounter when we encounter Jesus Christ, we encounter the truth.
Yes.
And we...
It's funny, in your situation, you have an employer talking to employees about being honest and dishonest and saying, hey, it's okay to be dishonest.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I get that in writing?
Actually, the moderator agreed with me. I was watching the expression of the vice president, and the vice president was just kind of watching me. She didn't have any comment, but what can you say when you're going to be talking about academic integrity and honesty for 30 minutes?
Yep.
Who's going to say, oh no, we want dishonesty? It's interesting, just the topic. It's hard to argue against that.
And it's very public in one sense. They don't want to be labeled as not being for diversity,
equity,
and inclusion. Mm-hmm. And so they'll try to be non-existent, right?
Mm-hmm. I think it's so wise that you ask questions along the way. You know, I've learned from you guys several how important that is. And it makes you more, less obnoxious. I mean, you know, speaking of myself, less obnoxious in my approach if I ask questions.
But, you know, with Jesus here, he's encountering an alternative worldview, which is saying about him, he's possessed of the devil. He's doing things by the power of the devil. We know what God wants, and the gloves are off. Mm-hmm. This is not about being socially acceptable or winning friends and influencing others. It's about the truth, and he just gives it that way.
A big thing is discernment in all of this. You know, you see times when it is shocking how abrasive Jesus is, or when he's cleansing the temple, and yet you have times when he's so compassionate and so overlooks things and just gets to the relationship side of things. And so we can't, I've heard people say, well, you know, Jesus treated people like this, so I can, you know, get on Twitter or Facebook and take the whip to the to cleanse the temple. It's like, he was also discerning. He wasn't doing that just all the time to everybody.
And it's often disputable about whether Jesus actually did what they're doing. You know, that's their analysis.
Right.
Because he said some strong words that I can say anything I want is strong. No, that's not kind of, that's not the same thing. But anyway, I think we can see here that in these two passages, he is saying, you don't know what's valuable. You have placed value on the wrong things. What else? Number two, he criticizes them for misplaced love. In Luke chapter 11, verse 43, he says, "Woe unto you Pharisees, for you love the uppermost seats in the synagogues and greetings in the markets." Now, in one sense, this is still under the category of values, but it addresses something specific about our human nature, our capacity to love, to cherish, to desire. And you find in life, if you reflect on your history and how you grew up, when you were a child, you encounter certain things that you just love or think you do. I want this. Perhaps you see it in a catalog before Christmas. And in our house back in the day, we used to get a Montgomery Ward's and a JCPenney catalog. Their Christmas catalog. And I mean, they had everything. Everything. And so you go through the catalog and you find the stuff that really stands out to you and you put it on the list and hope to get it. You sometimes earmark certain things. I really want this. This is really... But anyway, I guess now you go on Amazon or something like that and put it in your wish list. But anyway, this process, I mean, I think surely you can identify with having things in life that you really cherish, that you really want, that you really like, that you look forward to. I know some people, every day they look forward to waking up so they can have another cup of coffee or something like that. Yeah. That's alien for me, but I understand that happens. So the loves in your life. And so he says, you Pharisees, you love the uppermost seats. So you like to be elevated in people's eyes. You like for people to praise you. The greetings in the markets. Oh, there's Pharisee so-and-so. He's important. He's religious. He's observant. He's respected. And they love that kind of reception, the big crowds. And so this is a criticism. He says, this is what you love. So it's a love to perform for an audience of many, but a failure to notice that you are always performing for an audience of one. And of course then, a failure to love his approval. So compare their love for the cheers and the admiring, lost my word there, of the crowds, but not a love for God's approval. For some people, that's a very foreign idea. The idea that in your relationship with God, you reflect on his approval. I want his approval in my life. We have so championed the notion of a love that is unconditional that we have lost the dimension of relationship where we want to please God. For some people, God's love is just, it's there, it's automatic. I can sin, I can not sin, but he still loves me just the same. Just the same. Well, you lose the relationship. I want his approval in my life. I want him to be happy with me. As opposed to pleasing everybody else. As opposed to loving the shouts of the crowd. And, I mean, humanly, there's no question about it. There's nothing like a crowd that's excited about something. It's infectious. Even just to hear it, if you hear the sound of a big crowd at some venue that is clapping and applauding, it's like, wow, did you hear that? It's an amazing, energizing force. Well, you can allow yourself to seek that and to love that and to want that. Or you can say, you know what? That happens and it's over and nothing's changed. I had the feeling and it's gone. What I really care about is the approval of God, because that's eternal. Or at least it has eternal consequences. So what is Jesus doing here? He is forming the minds of those that are seeking to follow him in terms of what they value, what they seek. And you lose all that if you just sort of brush the Pharisees aside as, well, they're just a bunch of hypocrites. That's all I need to know. Don't be a hypocrite and you're good to go. No, there's substance in his criticism of them. There's much to be learned in his criticism of the Pharisees.
You kind of got away a little bit from the value in terms of what you love more. But really that is you kind of came back to the issue, but that's still very starkly a value. What do I value more? What
yes.
do I want more? The admiration of the crowd or the approval of God. That's still...
Yeah. Yeah. Although I think it's important to help people register the dimension of love in their life. For a lot of people, it's like, this is a private compartment of my life. I can love what I want. You know, I love ice cream, or I love puppy dogs or whatever. That's just all about me. But those are things that you cultivate and you cherish, and they become a part of the center of how you think. And those are subject to evaluation in your relationship with God as much as anything else, as much as any other value. I will not cherish, even though it's attractive, there's no sin in being attracted by something. As a human being, we're designed to be attracted by things. But those attractions are not always valid. They're not always legitimate. And they can control you. They will control you unless there's some sort of discipline in your life. Most of us are attracted to food, right? Do you like good food? Runs in our family. My mom liked good food too, and my dad. So, yeah, that's kind of that's kind of a human thing. You can let it control your life and your thinking and your mind, and therefore, you can get so badly out of shape and out of health that you're...
Kill yourself.
Yeah. You become a slave to it. So there's no sin in dwelling in a vessel that has those forces. The question is, what do you do with the impulses? Do you hold on to them? Do you cherish them? Do you form your life around them? Or do you discipline your mind to say, well, yeah, good food is great, but too much of it will kill you. And so it becomes something then which gets judged.
And what did Jesus say about this issue? Because he pretty much covers what we need to think about.
Yes. So we're... Yes.
Sorry. And on that note, just as a... It took me a while to figure this out, but... Because we are in bodies that are attracted to certain things, not to condemn ourselves for those, what attracts us, but also not to glory in what we're not attracted by and condemn others. So if you know, seeing the numbers of the current lottery don't have any draw on you, don't say, well, anybody that's drawn to that is stupid. You know, that's an extreme. But because some people, that might be what attracts them, then of course they have to decide what to do with that. So whatever it is, it's easy sometimes to beat ourselves up because why does that even attract me? Why does that particular commercial look so enticing? I'm not going to do it. I'm resisting it in my mind. But that I have to recognize some things pull on me more than others. Well, I can't take credit for resisting temptation when I'm not even attracted to some things. But recognize that my brother or sister might be.
Stupid as they are. Sorry. You didn't say that. I was kidding.
It's just that it's our nature. It's easy to get into that.
Yeah.
Why would anybody want that?
Yeah. And then it's really somewhat of a light bulb moment when you realize that, you know, there are millions of people that are spending billions of dollars every year to entice me.
Right.
Wow, if I had a budget like that, what could I do? You know? But that's, it's a thing. It's a whole world approach to manipulating human nature. And so they study the ways that you are most susceptible to enticement. Well, I don't want to be a victim of that. I don't know about you. That kind of takes the meaning of enticement, takes the value of it out. It's like, mercy, I want to be as far away from that as I can. Nobody wants to be a victim.
Keith, just to add,
yes.
What you said about discipline is so good. It's important to recognize who we are, what we are, what affects us, what direction we're going. To affect change, we've got to have something in place to help us get out. And then those who we're walking with, trying to help. I'm thinking about my granddaughters. I'm in a different place in life. They're not my children. So things are different for grandchildren. But even so, how do I communicate to them? This would go back to relationship here with what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Firmness, but gentleness, and interacting with them, trying to show them the best way, and wrestling through concepts, principles, how best to introduce it, what battles do I fight, when, what is best for them. I may have an idea of where I want them to be, but how do we get there? What's the best way to get there? And which will help them to grow and learn who Jesus is. And this discipline, if I can communicate that to them and explain to them the process, this isn't grandpa wanting to control you for my own pleasure. Mm-hmm. But I've got a goal that I want you to be transformed into the image of our Creator. And He has something beautiful for you. And so I'm helping you along with this. And I'm willing to do whatever I can to help you. That's part of the relationship.
Well, and you know, maybe we need to think about making discipline more enticing. That sounds weird, right? And sometimes we just sort of give up and say, yeah, you got to do it, right? So about if you're learning an instrument, just do it. It's hard, do it, and shut up. but maybe it's like, you know what? This is a path to possibilities that there's no other way to get there. Right? Now, discipline happens to people that survive at some point, period. Because if you don't discipline yourself, you end up in a major shipwreck. And if you recover from that, you start disciplining yourself because you remember how bad it hurt. And so you have people that wreck their lives, substances, relationships, whatever, and you find those are the people quite often that stay the farthest away from those things because they know where it leads. Well, if somehow we can teach the next generation that discipline is a positive thing, it is a good thing in your life. It is a tool to make life better. Then maybe we could sell it better. But anyway, I recommend discipline. Thank you for your kind attention.